Linda became ill in June 1950. A few weeks before she became desperately ill, she had asked me to find the little book in the set of the miniature Golden Books that she had loaned to a friend of ours, a woman who had a little girl named Susie. The woman's name was Louise Miller. Linda suddenly requested that I try to find Mrs. Miller because she wanted those little books very badly. They had been given to her by a friend in Urbana, Illinois, a Miss Foltz, a woman there who took care of children, who had become very fond of Linda, and of whom Linda was very fond. It, the little set, had been given to Linda as a parting gift when we had left Illinois to come to Baltimore to live. She wanted me to find Mrs. Miller, and I made an effort to, but it seemed that the woman had moved away from the apartment building where Linda and I had been living for a year, and she was not to be found. Later on, Mrs. Miller asked to keep the books after hearing about Linda's death, so that she could feel close to Linda, but then she didn't know how close. Linda suddenly became terribly ill in June and died in November. I had forgotten completely about the little books because, of course, I was with her all the time and there was no question about them again. She seemed to have forgotten. On November 16th, she died. She died a beautiful death. She was happy, and she went to her rest with a smile on the face. Her last words were, "Go rest, Mommy, and smile." I, of course, was exceedingly distraught and felt that I couldn't find an answer after the child had been taken away. She was a wonderful child, an only child. I sought many, many places to find some peace, and one day, a very good friend of the family, a very good, kind sort of person, Edward T. Norris, dined with us as we all sat at the kitchen table Linda and I had ordered shortly before her death. The table and three chairs were delivered almost exactly at the moment she died on November 16. Of course, we weren't there. We were at the hospital. It was brought back to the house much later on, weeks later. As Edward ate with us, he told me that he thought it would be good for me to attend an Episcopal church in the city of Baltimore, where he had been going all of his life. He had been taken there when he was just a tot by his mother. I decided that it might be a very good thing for me to do. I went to the church on a Sunday morning, and there I prayed very deeply that I would receive some help from God because I desperately needed it to go on living after losing Linda. A few days later, I was taking a little rest in the afternoon at my home, lying in the same spot where Linda lay in her last illness. I was half asleep, looking at the top of the tall oak trees, and I saw, suddenly, so clearly up above in the sky, a vision enclosed in a white mist. I saw the top of a church where there were ensculpted all these figures of the Christmas story, and around the circle, within the white mist, were circling many, many white angels, angels whose feet were all crossed in exactly the same way. The feet were strong. They looked like our feet, the feet of people like us, people here on earth, but they were extremely strong and well-formed. Their hands were all folded in prayer. Their clothing was all exactly alike. Their hair was drawn back in exactly the same way with a sort of bun at the back of the neck. I couldn't tell what sex they were by their facial expression or form. They all looked the same, and there was a feeling of complete stability, absolute poise, peace, and happiness, of contentment, and reassurance on their faces, especially the one large angel in the center who stood poised for a little while, looking at me with an expression of complete assurance. I was smiling. I felt so completely happy that I knew real peace for the first time since I had lost Linda. Then that angel suddenly came very close to me, a motion not perceptible in space. There were certain very striking qualities about these heavenly figures, these angels, which I recall as vividly now as I did at the moment I saw them. "The most precious gift is one that cannot ever perish," said the Scottish poet George MacDonald. And, "if instead of a gem or even a flower, we could cast the gift of a lovely thought into the heart of a friend, that would be giving as the angels must give." There was a lastingness, an everlasting unendingness about the angels. In communicating to me, no words were spoken, but I understood, with another sense, the message they brought. The intellect of the angel was manifested by the power of projecting thought in this way. It was the one angel who came closer, moving towards me in a motion of immobility and transportation at the same time there in space, that we humans cannot have. For instead of my seeing the movement, the angel was suddenly much, much closer and bigger. It was this angel who placed this tremendous healing within me. the warmth of great love during this vision, the communication without spoken words, the force drawing us together into this harmony of love and understanding and strength, and the placidity and intensification of a bit of earthly time into a never-ending timelessness of creation, so that a new significance is attached to everything little or big. These were the most sharply vivid memories that stay every moment with me, as the constant circling never diminished within the white clouds of mist, and no unnecessary motion disturbed their tremendous concentration of movement. They brought their message. The unvarying uniformity of these beings was like snowflakes falling heavily through white floods of snow, laden with heaven-sent whiteness and bulk. But just like each snowflake is different in its own perfection and intricacy and pattern, each of these angels had a completeness and unity within itself while being part of an undisturbed harmonious whole, a quiet splendor. The intensity of this experience stemmed from the heightening of the senses and the use of sense beyond our known senses and perception. The snowflake and all other small parts of this earthly universe had become much more intense, having more meaning. Because of this overflow of intensity, understanding, and awareness and quiet of the existence of these spiritual beings. Their bodily immobility and their gracefulness of their perfect placidity, this lack of needless motion enabled no interference to their ability to project the message. As in an illness, our bodies, through lack of motion, allow our minds to see with much more clarity. It was through this that they centralized their spiritual nature. A summary of the qualities most dominant in this vision. 1. Communication. Ability to project message through a sense we don't ordinarily use. No language, but a unity of understanding, a union in a different sense than seeing, hearing, speaking. 2. Harmony. Lack of interference with communication. No motion apparent disturbing the strength and power and stability, poise. Lack of any ineffectual motion in concentration of motion in circular movement. No disturbance of simplicity of motion directed to giving message. The actions completely subordinated to constant flow in ordered procession. The movement closer of the angel in the center did not stop the train of movement of cloud. Particles simply became magnified and closer and then further away. It was not like any motion we ourselves, as humans, use in our movements through space. 3. Intelligence. A knowing not striven for, already there, a learning not gradual, but instantaneous. No reasoning, no hesitation, or struggle to apprehend. Simple apprehension. A truth, a reality, a living vital knowing, not learning. Next, I wanted very badly to put this beautiful vision down on paper, so that it would be a remembrance to me of the happiness I had felt during that vision, visitation, or whatever it can be called. I made a little sketch on a little piece of paper I had around the house and used just a plain, ordinary pencil, but into that picture I put every line and every feature that I could have seen and remembered as clearly as I possibly could. Unfortunately, I tried so hard that I smeared the central angel's face and couldn't get the feet crossed the way they really were. Then I wanted so badly to make a large painting out of it because it was so beautiful. I wanted others to see it, and I wanted to be able to put it into color, but I was tired, and I didn't have any real desire to do anything much. I was worn out from caring for my little girl for months, so I just let it go, and then, a few days later, I was called by the art department of Towson High School to substitute. This was the high school in the county where we lived. I had been there many times in many departments, but never before in the art department or in any other department for more than a day or so at a time because, of course, the teacher always came back when I got underway and really got the kids to respect me, not throw things at each other, and so forth. So there I was in the art department. I looked around me, and there was every material that anyone could possibly need for a fine painting. I had the material for a class in composition because I had the idea of a composition design with a straight line and a circular line and so forth. I thought that the best way I could possibly teach something in this class was by standing up there and showing them how I myself would go about painting a picture. It was quite successful, and they did many things. The class itself responded beautifully, and I got my painting done. On the last day, when I wanted to put the angel's wings on, I couldn't decide whether I should put white or yellow wings. I saw no yellow in those angels, only white. But because I saw yellow wings on a study by Blake, the idea came to me, perhaps I should put yellow wings on the angels instead of white. It was an unspoken thought, and I stood there for quite a while thinking about it. Finally, I put the white wings there and took my picture and left. I went to the faculty club of the university, where we had dinner quite often, and I happened to meet the friend who had sent me to the church. We had our dinner, and then I asked this friend to come over to the car to look at the painting and tell me how he liked the way I had painted the church. He came over to the car, and I took the painting out and showed it to him. He just stood there. He looked so mystified and so perplexed that I asked him what was wrong. He finally said, "Why, Eleanor, you've painted the interior of the church exactly as it was more than 35 years ago, before the church was completely remodeled." I was as mystified then as he was. That was before I was born. I said, "Do you mean these angels look exactly like the ones that were on the walls over there?" He said, "They were circling around just like that. They were large and they were..." I don't think the pose was the same. There are certain things not the same. "And they were clothed in garments that were tinted," he said. "That is, I think they were. I was a little boy, and I can't remember exactly." It mystified and amazed me so much that when I got home, my eyes seemed to become almost blind from the shock, and I went around the house turning on all the lights because I felt so in the dark about the whole thing. Meanwhile, many other incidents had happened, all surrounding the little book, the little golden books that Linda had wanted just before she became so ill, and the woman who had borrowed the little golden books. Soon after Linda's death, I was told to go out and take regular walks. I didn't want to take walks. I didn't want to do very much of anything. I had a very tired, worn-out feeling, a desperate sort of feeling of loss, and I really didn't want to do anything very much. It was an effort to do anything. I was having difficulty breathing because of a rapidly beating heart that was bothering me and tying me down so that I couldn't seem to get out and take the exercise that I needed. I found out that I did need it because a heart specialist in Baltimore who examined me said, "The thing for you to do is to get out and take walks. Take little trips and take walks and do some light exercise such as swimming." Well, the advice was excellent. However, I didn't follow it right away until one day I happened to be driving my mother downtown and she happened to have a want ad section of the paper lying on the front seat. When she got out for her errand, I picked it up and started to look at it. As I looked at it, I saw, "Young lady wanted to do some walking for photographer and to assist in learning the business." And I thought, how wonderful. There's the advice Dr. King gave me. I think, perhaps, I will go in and see this man. It so happened that the place itself was just about 4 doors away from where my car was parked. So when my mother came back, I asked her if she would stay in the car for a few minutes and I'd run up to see about this photography job. All I had left of Linda to look at was her pictures. And it meant so much to me that I thought to myself, it's probably the best way for me to help others. After all, you never know what is going to happen. And those pictures were more valuable to me than anything that existed in the world, because there was Linda. I could look at her, and I could feel that she was with me, and yet, of course, she wasn't. Well, I went up to see this photographer, Mr. Lynch. He was a short man, of very slight stature, and he impressed me as being very assiduous on his job, and that he would expect a great deal from anyone who did work for him. And I thought, this is one way of getting out and getting some exercise. I don't know whether it will be just what I had expected, because he told me that the actual job was to get out and just walk, 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 and get these women with new babies to sign up for free pictures. Of course, that appealed to me very much, because I thought, after all, every mother with a new baby has begun to feel the attachment and the desire to retain the memory of each day and the love and the care that we give to our beloved children. And I thought to give these free pictures to these new mothers was a most wonderful thing. Exactly what I wanted to do. I said, "All right, I'll start out in the morning then." He said, "You start out and I'll find the section." Then he turned to a map of Baltimore City, and on that map, he picked the place where Linda had gone to school. I thought, that's a funny coincidence, but I'm so glad because I'll be walking in the same area where Linda and I used to walk so much. I'll recall some more of the wonderful memories I have of her. We decided that I would start off in the morning. He gave me the list of places and told me to go ahead and name the streets and so forth where I was to start. It just so happened that it was January 1951, but the weather had suddenly become April weather or May weather. It was springtime in January. When I started out, I shed my coat and hat and walked briskly along. I was so happy because I was remembering Linda when she was with me. I was striding along, not burdened by a lot of clothes, and I was doing something that would bring happiness to other people with little children. Along about 3 or 4 o'clock, I began to drag quite a bit. I was becoming awfully tired. Shortly before that, I had gone into a home where I saw my Aunt Pearl and Uncle Lou's picture on a table, to my surprise. That was on Wadsworth Way, at the home of Dr. Eleanor Scott, the daughter-in-law of my aunt and uncle. I had gathered many appointments, but I felt as though, oh my heavens, I don't know how much farther my feet are going to carry me. Well, along about 4:30, when I was due back in his office at 5 o'clock, I sort of dragged myself onto the wrong street when, suddenly, I looked up and there, crossing the street, was the woman who had borrowed the little books from Linda. She was just as amazed as I was to see her, and asked me to come in to visit with her for a few moments. I went in to visit her, and there I had a tremendous experience. I told her about Linda. She hadn't known. Louise was terribly hurt. She wept, and then she told me, "Eleanor, your child has appeared to me." She said that several days before I came to see her, she had awakened from a terrible sweat from head to foot. She had seen Linda, who had appeared to her in tremendous brilliance, so bright and so shining and clothed in a beautiful light of a soft, rosy color. Linda was dancing and laughing, and she said, "Go find my mommy and tell her that I want her." No, she didn't say that. She said, "Go find my mommy. She is terribly upset, and you've got to help her." Well, when I heard that, it was just sort of a climax to a day of complete readjustment for me. I had been back in the old places where Linda and I had walked and talked and been happy together, and then to hear this, that Linda had appeared to this woman. The strangest thing about it all was that Louise Miller had awakened from this terrible cold sweat holding the book about the little kittens out of the set of golden books. It was a revelation of some sort to me that she was holding a little book out of the set that Linda so badly wanted before she became very ill. I felt rather unable to cope with the tremendous happenings because at that moment I was dreadfully tired. I had to get back to the man's office and turn in the appointments for the next morning, so I said, "Louise, I'm so grateful to you. I just feel so completely happy and completely sad at the same time that I'd better say goodbye just now and then see you again soon." So I left, and I turned in all my receipts at the little folk studio. Mr. Lynch was glad that I had worked so hard and so forth, and he wanted me to come back. But when I got home that night, I had a terrible chill because I had gone ahead and shed my coat and hat. I came down with the flu right after that, and I was in bed for 3 weeks and nearly got pneumonia. I never did get back there, never got the money that he was supposed to pay me, but I didn't want the money. I felt that my reward was so tremendous that I didn't want a cent for anything I had done. Just to have heard that Linda had visited Louise brought me happiness, which was not to be bought at any price. I had found Louise Miller. The contact had been made. She knew where I was living, and I knew where she was living. So when the incident about the painting occurred, she was able to get in touch with me. Louise called me on the telephone the day after this friend and I had realized that the painting was an identical thing from the past. She said to me, "I want you to tell me what band so completely mystified you or startled you last night so that you went home and turned on all your lights." I was so amazed to think that she had known something that she had no way of knowing about that I couldn't speak for a moment, and then I realized it. She said, "It was about 8 o'clock." She knew the time. She described the man. Described him very, very carefully, and I just couldn't understand how she could have known. Well, she went on from that. She said, "I knew that this had happened to you. Last night, Linda appeared to me again. She came in the same tremendous brilliance, and I awoke in a cold sweat, holding the same little book. Linda said to me, 'Go find my mommy again. Tell her to go back to the church and look up the history of the church and put yellow wings on the angels.'" I cried over the phone. I was so completely mystified and yet so completely happy at the same time that I just wept and wept at the release from tension, the terrific tension that was built up while she was telling me this, because the mystery of it was so tremendous. I put yellow wings on the angels and went back to the church. I talked to the minister, a very fine man, who is a sincere person, who gives all the help he can very freely and does it in a very beautiful way, and I said, I've told you this story. How can I find out what she's trying to tell me, what Linda's trying to do for me? Where is it all leading? He said, it's most unusual that your child, so soon after her death, could be doing this for you and could have such tremendous powers for you, but it is most possible. She must be a very strong spirit of some kind. I think she must have found great happiness. That was what I wanted to hear. I felt such tremendous happiness to hear those words, and he really meant them too. He really did mean them. Then I thought, I'm going to try to do everything that I can if in any way it's going to bring her peace and in any way going to bring me the happiness she must want me to have. I asked Mr. Cox, the minister, do you think you could look up the history of this church? Do you have the history of this church? He said, we do have certain reports and so forth, but the church was done over, you see, a certain number of years ago, which corroborated the statement of this friend of mine. And when this church was done over, some of the records were misplaced, but we do have in our vault a picture of the angels that were painted in the church 35 years ago. I said, may I see it? He said, of course. So he got this picture out of the vault, and I saw that there was a great similarity between it and the painting. In the ceiling over the altar, there was a round window, brilliant with the light shining through it, as I had seen it in the dream before the visit to Mrs. Ivy's apartment. He said, but I want to tell you this. I feel that what she meant was that you should go back maybe 2,000 years in the history of the church. He said, any revelation of this kind coming from God to help you means something great. It can't be just one small thing. It can't be just one church. It has to mean something big because it wouldn't have happened otherwise. He said, you must go back maybe 2,000 years in the history of the church, and there you will find the answers to your questions. I can't answer you just now about why you should put yellow wings on the angels, or why the feet of the angels looked the way they did, and why they were crossed in the same way, nor why they were circling in a white mist. It sounds something like Dante's The Circles. You must go back and study the history of the church. God had used Linda to bring me back to the church, a sure way to get me there. I saw his hand in the evolution of the painting. He had to bring me back to the church. He used different people, and many different ways, and the placing of the tools in my hand for the painting. There were many bypaths, Louise, Mr. Lynch, the high school, and the roads I walked, before I found out clearly that I was meant to return to the church, and the second visit had come about. I knew now that next I had to study. I got started. For the first time at Walter's Art Gallery, a course was being offered, beginning in February, by Miss Dorothy Minor, an authority on the medieval illuminated manuscript, which, of course, takes you back to the beginnings of the Christian church and the history of the Jewish church. Being interested in painting and wanting to learn all about the illustrations of the history of the church, I was very lucky that she had consented to give this course. She was starting in a couple of weeks. I signed up for the course and started to study the history of the church by studying the medieval illuminated manuscript. I started studying the history of the Christian and Jewish churches, and then I found, through the assistance of one of the professors, Dr. George Boaz of Johns Hopkins University, the references to use of yellow and other colors in the church. Yellow, the color of gold, always meant, from the very beginning, a direct revelation from God. St. Peter was always clothed in yellow for that reason. Yellow means the goodness of God, and it has many attributes. Then I found out about the feet of the angels in the writings of Pseudo-Dionysius and Areopagite. There were two men known as Dionysius. One, Dionysius the Areopagite, was the first convert of St. Paul, Saul of Tarsus, the Jew, who was converted and ordained by Christ to teach the message of the gospel. He traveled all over the places where the message was to be carried and was one of Jesus' apostles, of course. He is mentioned in Acts 17:34. The other Areopagite was Pseudo-Dionysius. I found some quotations while digging for material to write a paper on the history of the angels for Miss Minor. In just a minute, I'll get them out of the little notebook I brought with me and read them. Here they are. It was Dionysius who first gave the church a complete angelology. In his celestial hierarchy, he presents an organized angelic world, harmoniously coordinated in a descending ladder from seraphim to simple angels. We can only offer a brief summary of his treatise here. First, we may say that he considered all of the heavenly spirits to be of the same nature, but differing in rank according to their particular order, knowledge, and function. Their purpose in existence is to attain the closest possible likeness to God and be united to Him as closely as possible. Each single order of the heavenly hierarchy profits personally from a purification, illumination, and perfection received from God, which it then communicates to the order below it in due measure. Angelic knowledge comes either directly from God or through an infused vision that is in accord with their rank in the hierarchy and their closeness to God. They know divine truth before men, since it is they who bear it to man. They communicated divine revelations to us through the patriarchs, through Moses, the prophets, Zachary, Mary, Joseph, and the shepherds. All the members of the heavenly orders are messengers by nature, but only the archangels and angels are properly so called. Ad extra, ad intra. Among themselves, all the orders are messengers handing down to one another divine illuminations. The number of angels surpasses all our conceptions. It is known only by God. There are 9 orders of angels, joined together as links in a chain. Each order has a name denoting the functions of its members: seraphim, cherubim, thrones, dominations, powers, virtues, principalities, archangels, angels. The 9 choirs are divided into 3 hierarchies of 3 orders each, from the seraphim, closest to God, down to the angels, closest to men. Dionysius makes no mention of individual guardian angels, but does say that each nation has a particular angel presiding over it to guide it in following out the course of God's providence. The care of the Jewish nation has been assigned to the archangel Michael. Besides possessing their proper perfections, each order has those of the orders inferior to it, but the opposite is not true. Dionysius presupposes the absolute spirituality of the angels as intelligent, intelligible, simple beings without the least material quality of figure. The closing chapter tells us that the corporeal terms applied to the angels in Scripture are only accommodations made to sensible men. Elsewhere, it is said that the angels were created in eternity, men in time. Angels are the measure of eternity, since they are closest to it, and men of time. That's all I copied, but it helped me understand about the orders of angels. The angels are also described as circling around the throne of God at the highest. Circling around above at the highest point above the throne of God is the group of angels called the seraphim. The lowest group of angels, the ones that are the nearest to us on earth, are called the angels. And they are the direct messengers to us from God. They are described by Dionysius as encircling continuously around the throne of God in tremendous placidity and stability in a white mist. The various spheres of angels, of course, circle around just in the way they're supposed to be in the hierarchy, like a ladder, sort of like Jacob's ladder, where the top angels are nearest to God and the lowest are nearest to us. It is somewhat like in the Old Testament of the Jewish Shekinah, where, in this complete absorption in the mysteries of the celestial holiness, the Jew forgets everything except the mystery and the tremendous wonder of the throne and the various powers and dominations of powers through which the message of God descends from the throne of God down to us. Then there is also the idea of God's removal from us, perhaps 7 heavens away. With the fall of man, the sin of Adam, He removed Himself 1 heaven away, and each time that man has sinned since the beginning, He has removed Himself another heaven away. Now He is 7 heavens away from us, and through this 7, this celestial hierarchy, this must come to us, you see, through various messengers, the lowest being the angel, the direct messenger to us. This is the reason the feet of the angels are so strong, so beautifully formed, wonderfully poised, and almost, oh, just tremendously powerful-looking, tremendously graceful-looking, and yet like our feet, except that no one on earth has feet with quite the same proportion of strength. Angels' feet are so important because they must be very strong to be busy on the divine errands constantly. The whole matter seemed to be coming into the foreground as a sort of pattern, a pattern of learning, a pattern of assurance, and a pattern of living that I was to follow because everything that had happened has been for good, to help. I was so busy with all of this research I was doing, so engrossed in it all, that I wasn't surprised when one day, when I was sitting in the library stacks at Hopkins, completely lost in the study of the angels, I suddenly became terrifically hungry for a piece of candy. I wanted that candy the way I've never wanted a piece of candy before. 2 minutes later, Rabbi Martin Kessler from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, came over to me with a skullcap on his head, and he handed me a bar of candy. He said, "I just want you to have the candy." I was so amazed by the fact that all I had to do was to want candy to have it come to me that I thought, "Good heavens, what is this?" I forgot all about the candy, and then I realized that here was a man who could tell me where to find every reference to the angel in the Old Testament. I had all of the records and was following through to get it completely organized, the history of the angel in the Old and New Testaments. So he brought a concordance over to me, and he translated the Hebrew for me. By the time he got through, I thought, "This is worth far more to me than a piece of candy." And I knew when he came over and offered me that candy, there must be something else besides just candy. Things like that just don't happen every day. I was very happy to have all the references to angels in the Bible, and I incorporated them in the paper that I gave to Miss Minor at the end of the term. She read the paper, and she told me there was so much work in the paper that I was wallowing in this up to your ears, and I'd have to read it over when I'd cooled off a little bit and pick out the part I most wanted to work on. Well, meanwhile, a lot of other things had been happening. I had been working on an educational program for radio combining music and poetry, and I had to get it ready for May 14th, when I was to put it on for a group of people at the Stafford Hotel in Baltimore. This had been arranged by my friend Betty almost a year before. A week beforehand, I got dreadfully distraught because I had to get a record, a sound effects record, which had the sound of the wind on it, and I couldn't get it in Baltimore. It was getting awfully late, and I didn't know how I could get it from New York in time. That evening, my brother-in-law, Bernard, who lives in Washington, called me up and said, "How would you like to go to New York, all expenses paid, with Dot? Go for 3 days and have a wonderful time, and I'll make all the arrangements for the trip tomorrow when I go to New York." I won't take no for an answer. You're absolutely going. Well, I thought, how wonderful. Another amazing thing. I really wanted that record so badly and was so worried about it. And there, suddenly, appears my chance to go to New York. So I went to New York and got the record and had a very, very wonderful time. When I came back, I put the program on, but previous to that, the real reason I'm telling all this is that there is a tie-in with the family of a policeman who had taken Linda across the street every day. He always had a smile for Linda, and she always had a smile for him. But I didn't know how fond he was of her until after he was run over and killed by an automobile in front of his church, the Roland Park Presbyterian, 6 weeks after Linda's death, near the same school where he had helped her cross the street. I visited the family. There was a lot of publicity about what had happened, and everybody wanted to help them. I took a lot of things over when I called on them. The child who opened the door was the eldest child of this patrolman, Roland Morgan. He had been a wonderful father, a kind husband, and was deeply beloved. It was a terrible tragedy to that family. I felt very close to them, closer still when, after I'd been in there for an hour, they told me that at Linda's death he had come home to them with tears and told them he felt so horrible because a little child that he dearly loved had died and that he had wanted his children to know Linda. They told me all these things, and while I was working on the program, I had rewritten it in the form of a little play. There was lots of music and poetry in it, and I needed a little child who would take the part of Linda in the story, and Dorothy Morgan, a lovely, alert girl who was very beautiful with blue eyes and blonde hair, very deeply upset at her father's death and needing help very badly, was just the child, I felt, for the part. We became very good friends. I loved her very much, and she loved me very much. We helped each other a great deal through our terrible grief, and she did quite well on the program. Those several weeks when she and I were working together and having fun together, I wanted so badly to go into the closet in Linda's room and take out her doll, a storybook doll, all dressed in lace, which was in a white box with blue circles on it. I couldn't bring myself to go into that closet. I couldn't bring myself to take away anything there. There was the feeling that Linda was there, though of course she wasn't. But we hold on to things for a while, and at the same time, I wanted so badly to go in and take that box out of there, give that doll to that child, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Suddenly, Mrs. Miller called me. She had found me at my mother's home. She'd been trying to get in touch with me for hours and hours and had tried to get me at my home, but I wasn't there. She finally reached me at my mother's home. She said, "Eleanor, Linda has appeared to me for the third time." Again, I was holding the same little book. I awoke in a terrible sweat. I saw Linda dancing and laughing, so happy. And she was saying, "You silly, weak, pretty, funny, lovely, mommy, dearest mommy, take the box." She saw my hand only, stretched out, taking this box, a white box with blue dots on it, the identical box, and Linda handed me the box so gleefully. That was the beginning of my release from this bond of trying to hold on to things that were no longer Linda's. She didn't want them. She wanted other children to have them and be happy with them. It was a wonderful help to me. I dashed home lickety-split, ran into the closet, grabbed that box, and took it over to that child's house so fast, and she was very happy to have the doll. The whole episode was really a wonderful help to me.